Succession number 23138, Reel 2.
Mr. Child, Reel 2. Can you tell me about this attack?
As a result, we lost most of our lovely new equipment, all the lovely new guns that we'd brought from England and so on. And we landed helter-skelter in Bone, in some disorganisation. And they made my battery. I was.
Could you give me more details about that attack? What, as you remember it?
Well, I don't remember much about it, except that there was a lot of noise and disorganisation, and we managed to get into Bone Harbour, my fast boat, and. Got on to land and got what was left of the equipment ashore, and they put enough equipment together to furnish my battery, the battery being two troops of the field guns. I was one troop commander and a friend was another, and we had a battery commander, Major Howard, who was a great guy, but he'd got himself unpopular with the bigwigs because he was originally a brigadier, and he was demoted to major and commanded our battery.
Which unit were you in?
This was the 106th Newfoundland Field Regiment.
And remember which troop you were in?
Well, it was C troop, the battery. I can't. The numbers are starting to escape me a little bit, I'm afraid. They made up our battery as best they could, and the second in command of the regiment got us together and gave a little speech, and he said that. In the speech he said, no Newfoundlander will ever be taken prisoner. And we weren't quite sure about that. We approved of it, but it was rather a stark statement. Anyway.
Were all your men Newfoundlanders?
Yes. All the. Everybody except just one or two officers.
What rank did you have at that time?
I was still a captain then, and we went inland, and at that time Montgomery was advancing, having won the Battle of Alamein, was advancing along the north coast past Tripoli into southern Tunisia, and Rommel was organizing the defense, the German defense of Tunisia, and he counterattacked our line a little further south from Bone. A pass through the mountains called the Kasserine Pass, and he went through the American defences, scattered them, and we were jammed in with the French army to stop that attack. So at that stage I was really in the deep end personally. I had a little tank called a top truck with a signaller and assistant and a driver, and this little top truck had so much gear in it to help us to get up to the front and shoot the guns, which were normally half a mile behind us or a mile or something like that.
What kind of artillery pieces did you have?
And these were 25 pounders. beautiful guns, very accurate and very effective. We lined up with the French, who were a little disorganized because they were supposed to resist us, because Marshal Pétain, the Vichy commander of France and North Africa, told them to do that, but they didn't. They came round and joined us, so they were themselves slightly disorganized. And the French battalion that we were with was commanded by a commandant, Leboeuf, who was a most wonderful character. I stuck to him as we stopped this offensive and tried to push them back. And as we started to go forward, he was in great form. We somehow produced a tank for him, and he treated this tank like a tank regiment as part of his force. One day before an advance, I went to his briefing, and there he was behind the crest of a hill, out of sight of the Germans, covered with a white sheet, sitting in a chair and being shaved by his orderly, and giving his orders to his company commanders. He was just a great sort of personality. He had a white horse, and he used to ride this white horse at terrific speed through almost through no man's land in front of us and so on. And he always seemed to get away with, everything. He was a great leader and a great character.
What was his name?
Leboeuf. Leboeuf, I think.
And his rank?
Commandant, commander, I suppose, between a major and a colonel, probably. The French gave their foreign overseas forces their best officers. I mean, he really was a cracking soldier. But he upset me one day, because going through the night advancing, I got my little tank up through a very wet and miserable and cold night along a track with mines either side of it, because the Germans mined everything they could in as they went back. These were landmines. I eventually, in the dawn, just got to the top of the hill where Leboeuf was in his dugout with his assistant and his radio and so on. And I hadn't got my radio wasn't through to the guns. I wasn't in communication with them. Of course, I had no telephone line or anything like that. And when he saw me, he switched on his radio and he very triumphantly announced, he said, "Artillery support is assured." And of course, he hadn't got a clue that it was nothing like that. I mean, I was hoping to get it available very soon, but it wasn't at that particular stage. But he was a great guy, and worked rather disjointedly with my major, who, as I said, was Major Howard, and a very gung-ho gentleman. He expected everybody around him to be gung-ho and terribly brave and all that sort of business. Perhaps we weren't all in that level. But he tried to command the French forces as best he could, with some success. But anyway, we got on and pushed on slowly. We were now pushing towards Tunis city, in that direction. Various things happened. At one time, I was given a platoon of Goumiers, who were the Algerian patrol troops, local Algerians who wore sort of dressing gown they were sort of brigand type of types of dressing gown uniforms, so that they were completely camouflaged, and they all had black beards and hairy faces, and they were really quite terrifying to look at. I was given a patrol of these chaps, and they were wonderful patrol troops, perhaps in the direction of perhaps our Gurkhas, something like that. Good patrollers, and we went out at night patrolling into the German lines, and I would go with a signaller who had a walkie-talkie on the back of his back. And in those days, radios were huge and heavy, with batteries and goodness knows what. These days they would have pocket size walkie-talkie telephones, but these were heavy. Anyway, we travelled through the night on these patrols in the direction of the German lines, and the goons escorting me would disappear, just like that, and you'd be walking down the path by yourself, and then all of a sudden something would touch you on the shoulder, and you look round and there's one of these horrifying faces within inches of you, and that was more scaring than anything, really. But they were great guys, and we found a hole as close as we could to the German lines, and sat in it through the day, and any firing that we could do, we had to do in a whisper because we were so close. The gooms would sit absolutely still for hours on end, not moving at all. But they had these sort of flashing eyes, and they could see things and point things out that I couldn't see, even with binoculars. They had these marvelous, this marvelous eyesight. And then through the day, you know, food was not on, but they would put their hands in their dressing gown pocket and pull out some really dirty-looking meat, and they'd pass it round, pass it to me and so on. And it was delightful. It was absolutely marvellous, but it was probably very unhygienic. I don't know. Anyway, we got back. That was what one of the patrols, which really one would rather not have to go on. It was not at all comfortable. Another time I was at the top of a mountain, Jebels they called them in North Africa, and we set up an observation post. Incidentally, I'd been appointed regimental observation officer by the colonel when we got to Africa, which meant that one had to be with the forward troops all the time, and we were army troops. We weren't with regiment and battalions. We were swapped to whoever wanted us in the front line, so we were nearly always in the front line. And so to be the regimental forward observation officer wasn't a particularly happy job. You really should check your insurance policies or something when you get a job like that. But firing the guns was obviously very interesting and very important. And we were on this Jebel. I found a niche at the top with my assistant and signaller, and 20 yards down behind was a cave, and we lived in this cave at night, and we had about between a 12 and a dozen Algerians in the cave. It's quite a big, huge cave, and at night we would light a fire. Well, they would light a fire well in the cave, because it mustn't be seen outside, and cook the food, which meant that the atmosphere the whole time was thick, smoky, heavy, unpleasant atmosphere. But the food was necessary. They used to find a collect a sheep occasionally and have things like congealed sheep's blood, cooked, marvellous protein. Not very pleasant, but useful as protein, I think. And it was a very interesting spot to be. The Germans used to come round the bottom of the Jebel at night in patrols, but they couldn't come up the hill because we fortified that and wouldn't let them. And then one day I was behind a rock, and a German, little small German spotter plane came round the Jebel and looking for us, I suppose. And I could see him, and he was below me, and it was just as if I was in a house, and he was coming up the road in this little spotter plane, and I could see his face so clearly and so near. And I realized that, you know, he was just a young, normal-looking guy trying to find me, and I was trying to hide from him, trying to find us, and I was trying to hide from him. And I realized that, that those guys were very similar to us, except they were on the other side of the fence. It was a very strange experience. But there we go. And then one day I was firing our guns at a line of tanks, which were German tanks, which were going along a road some mile or so in front of me on the plain. Up to my observation post came a chap called Mick Shields. He was my gun position officer, and he was later managing director of the Midland Bank, of the Daily Mail. He was quite a guy, and a great comedian, and a good bit younger than me. And he came up to my OP and he brought a telephone wire, because we, at that moment we only had radio contact with the guns, and he brought some food up, and, you know, he's a very welcome chap. And at this time I was running this chute. I was ranging the guns on the tanks on the road as I saw it on the left, and then swiveling the guns and then catching them with major fire on the right before they went out of view. And he described this operation just as if it was a sort of rugger match on the telephone to the whole regiment, who I understand were listening to hear what was happening. And it was just like a sporting commentary on a football match or something like that. It was quite amusing, except I wouldn't think it was very amusing for the tanks at the other end. That was probably a little bit different. But anyway, they were unusual times. It was great to be with the French. One's school French got turned into colloquial French. The only thing that we found particularly difficult was the rough red Algerian wine, which they filled our water bottles. That was terribly strong, and in the heat, of course, was very had to be careful with it.
What were relations like with the French?
Very good, very good. We're very, 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 very friendly. They were helpful, and they were still in a sort of slightly romantic, Beaujolais sort of time. You know, they weren't so well equipped and so terrifically efficient as perhaps the Germans were. it was very strange, but they did a great job because you know, the French were having a terrible time. They had no homeland security in the same way that that we did. I was always very sorry for odd people all around the world in the war who hadn't got any sort of country stability to go back to or anything like that. We prevailed in the war, provided we were winning, we knew that we had home and good old England to go back to if we could make it. But the French were in a lot of difficulties in that respect. Anyway, eventually we got back to the British forces, and the regiment was made up with guns and so on, and we went forward as a regiment. We chased up and down hills and Jebels, Long Stop comes to mind. Whenever we acquired a position, the Germans always counterattacked immediately before we could even dig holes to get into, and very often with panzer divisions had a lot of armour, and in the plains of North Africa, away from the mountains, the Atlas Mountains, away in the plains, the tanks and the panzers were very effective, and they had a horrible air attack available through Stuka aeroplanes. These Stuka dive bombers dive down at us out of the sun always, and nearly perpendicular. They were really horrifying. They came down straight at us, and always before they leveled off and went away again, there was a bomb at the end of it, and they were really very unpleasant. I got a little bit, I don't know what size it was, shrapnel in my leg, and the nearest medical unit bound up my leg and pushed me back, or didn't push me, but let me back into the struggle again. And as far as I know, that bit of shrapnel's still there, or moving around, wondering when it's going to get out. I think, I don't know, that wasn't pursued, but it was all difficult. But we pushed ahead. Through central Tunisia, the Americans switched to the north, and the British 8th Army came up from the south, and we, the chief direction of the attack, 1st Army, were in the centre, and we came to through Medjez El Bab, which was a communication center in the middle of Tunisia, to a hill called Bou Akaz, which was an important point. The North Staff's infantry took it. And the Germans counterattacked because it was an important hill. I got into a hole with the infantry commander next to me, and my assistants got into holes where they could, behind and so on. And when the counterattack came, I popped my head up, and it was really very unpleasant because we were completely surrounded with German Tiger tanks. Now, the Tiger tank was the great tank weapon that the Germans had at that stage. All I could see was three or four of these things around us, and with this very strong black cross, German cross on them, really very defiant, aggressive looking thing, and they were shooting at us. The Germans were also using something called a Nebelwerfer, which was a group of mortars going off together and going to quite a great height and coming down perpendicularly, so that being in trenches and holes wasn't all that a good defence, because they came down perpendicularly and they got into all the areas that you were you hoped would be safe. And then over the radio, to add to all this difficulty, I picked up a map reference that some artillery man somewhere else had ordered for all the regimental guns around to fire at this map reference, because obviously they'd seen the tanks. But it was our map reference. So not only did we have the enemy fire coming at us, but we had our own fire coming, and that was pretty unpleasant. So anyway, the North Staffs were marvellous. They held the hill, and the Germans had to go back at nightfall, because tanks are completely vulnerable in the dark. So our troops obtained that objective.
Did your troops take casualties at that time?
Great casualties on I think on both sides. I lost I lost several of my assistants in that battle, but I think that the tide was turning in Africa generally, and we pushed forward, shortly afterwards the First Army, supported, as I said, by the Americans on the north and the Eighth Army coming up, we got into Tunis, the war was practically finished, except that the whole world was fating the victory. Everybody was on the radio was congratulating us on having won this wonderful battle, but a unit of the German SS troops, their elite troops, had got themselves into a mountain just south of Tunis and resisted and wouldn't give way. So we were sent to sort them out. And while we were doing that, the troops were all being congratulated in Tunis. But anyway, our infantry accomplished that. We got down back into Tunis, by which time they were having a triumphal march past in down the great promenade in Tunis City, and all the big wigs were there. I think Mr. Churchill and all the leaders were on the podium, and we got there just as it had started, and we were absolutely whacked, but we just had time to clean one side of the vehicles,